Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the Lauterbach Centre for International Law's Friday lecture series, which is kindly supported by Cambridge University Press. I am really delighted to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Loveday Hodson. Loveday is Associate Professor at the University of Leicester, where she teaches international law, feminist perspectives in international law, and legal responses to global injustice. Together with Troy Labors, she led the Feminist International Judgments Project, which was subsequently published as Feminist Judgments in International Law, a tremendously important work for our discipline and one that I use in my own teaching. Today, she will be speaking on gender and the international judge, misfits on the bench. She'll speak for around 30 to 40 minutes, which will leave us time for questions and discussion. As I'm sure you're all familiar with by now, if you would like to ask a question, please enter it in the Q&A box, which you'll find at the bottom of your screen. And one of the advantages of Zoom is that you don't need to wait until the end to type in your question. You can do so at any time. So with that, Loveday, welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much for this very kind invitation to talk today at the Lauterbach Centre. It's a real pleasure to be here with you, and thank you for the kind introduction. The talk today draws on the project that Professor Sivakumaran mentioned, the Feminist Judgments International, but I want to specifically foreground today the relationship between gender international judging, and in doing so today, I want to suggest that in thinking about the institutional role of gender, we move beyond questions of parity and arguments grounded in representation that have tended to dominate discussions. The arguments for parity are, I suggest, not particularly strong and risk reinforcing institutional and structural discrimination. I nonetheless, of course, argue that gender matters profoundly. And I'll come back to that point at the end. So let me just work through these ideas then, and I very much look forward to your comments and questions. So the first point then is, faced with enduring disparity, parity on the international benches should nonetheless not be seen as an endpoint in itself. So in making this argument, I of course acknowledge that it's abundantly clear why parity has been a dominant focus of discussions about gender and international judging. There's an enduring underrepresentation of women on international benches, which reflects a wider pattern of exclusion throughout international organs and institutions. Efforts to increase the numbers of women on some tribunals while having success have also met with institutional resistance. Ninki Grossman's comprehensive survey of international courts, published in 2012, found that the percentage of female judges on 11 international courts in total since their establishment averaged at only 15%, an average pulled up considerably at that point by the International Criminal Court's 44%. At that point, the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea's percentage stood at 0%. The International Court of Justice percentage was just 3%. The European Court of Justice is 7%. The International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, 15%, and the World Trade Organization's appellate body, 19%. So that's how the picture looked about 10 years ago. And this notwithstanding that gender equality is a well-established norm of international law. International law's normative commitment has led to specific measures being taken to improve the representation of women in international institutions. The UN General Assembly has adopted Resolution 5169 that calls on states to commit themselves to gender balance in all international bodies, institutions, and organizations, notably by presenting and promoting more women candidates. This resolution has had some impact since the data indicates an upward trajectory around this time. In 2010, for instance, two female judges were appointed to the International Court of Justice, who had been preceded by only one female judge in the history of the court, Rose Higgins. In 2015, the General Assembly adopted a further resolution calling for gender parity throughout the United Nations. More recently still, in July 2019, the Human Rights Council has adopted a resolution calling for a balanced gender representation in the composition of international bodies at all levels. And the CEDAW committee is meeting in a few days to discuss a new general recommendation on equal and inclusive representation of women in decision-making systems. A few international courts and tribunals have founding instruments that make specific reference to sex and or gender representation. For instance, gender representation is a mandatory consideration for the appointment of judges to the African Court of Human and People's Rights, which was established in 2004. The International Criminal Court famously requires a fair representation of female and male judges. And it further goes on to require states parties to take into account the need to include judges with legal expertise on specific issues, including violence against women or children. Such provisions seem to affect change, as these two tribunals have consistently had some of the highest percentage of women on their benches. So our starting point is that there is institutional recognition of disparity, and there has been a significant response. Yet the problem of representation overall is an enduring one. GIQUAL, the Campaign for Parity in International Representation's most recent data, puts the total number of women in international tribunals at 33%. The present day picture points to a gradual overall increase in women's representation, but also startlingly, some areas particularly resistant to this trend, and even some backsliding. So the International Court of Justice currently has 4 women on its bench of 15 judges. The International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea now has 5 female judges out of 21. But in the most recent nominations, 7 out of the 10 nominees were men. Criminal law and human rights tribunals have a stronger representation of women. I've already mentioned the International Criminal Court that's now achieved parity with 9 women out of 18 judges. The European Court of Human Rights has 17 female judges out of 46. The African Court of Human Rights, 6 out of 11. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights, 3 female judges out of 7 judges. And for human rights treaty bodies, the figure is 51%. So we have something of a mixed picture here. Despite the apparent effectiveness of including provisions aimed at addressing gender imbalance and their consistency with the norm of gender equality, they've not been widely adopted. And they've certainly not been without their detractors. And the thing that becomes abundantly clear is the progress that these figures that I've outlined seems to indicate can't be taken for granted. I think that's a crucial point. There is clear precedent for the numbers of women on international benches reducing. Certain tribunals and certain states have certainly been more resistant to these changes. The other point that seems clear is that there are pockets of international law, human rights particularly, but also international criminal law, where women sit on benches, tribunals or committees in greater numbers. Conversely then, important swathes of international law effectively remain resistant to women judges. So this isn't an enduring issue. We can certainly note progress, but there is an enduring resistance that I think merits our attention. The argument I would like to go on to make, though, is that arguments for parity are not particularly strong. While the idea that the gender composition of courts and tribunals matters has broad academic and institutional as well as normative support, there is little agreement on the question of why it matters. Several studies of national judges have considered the question of gender representation from an essentialist perspective, looking for empirical evidence that demonstrates sex or gender-based differences in the ways that men and women perform their judicial functions. The findings from these studies, however, have been inconclusive and inconsistent. When it comes to studying gender effects on international benches, the small number of female international judges, as well as the collaborative nature of decision-making, makes empirical analysis of outcomes challenging. Notwithstanding these challenges, some social scientists have taken up the baton and attempt to investigate. In a 2005 study of the impact of personal characteristics on the decisions of the judges of the former ICTY, James Murnick and colleagues concludes that women are neither more nor less likely to sentence those found guilty to lengthier sentences, and that despite a heightened awareness of the victimization of women in the Balkan Wars, women sentenced no differently than men. In a subsequent study by King and Greening, it was found that with regard to charges of sexual violence, the interaction of judicial and victims' gender matters for sentencing outcomes, but only in a modest way. So the take-home point here seems to be that sex and gender may matter somewhat, at least in an international criminal law context, looking at two particular areas of outcome, guilt or innocence and the length of sentence handed down. But this is hardly a wide, solid argument for essential difference that upon which we can build an argument for parity. A recent study by Eric Burton of the effects of sex and gender on the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights used a matching method that compares the decisions of male and female judge with otherwise similar characteristics. And that provides only limited support for difference-based arguments too in the human rights context. So my conclusion is there's only limited evidence to suggest that sex and gender is an important differential in how judges perform their role. So consequently, arguments based on sex and gender differences that directly correlate to outcome provide only weak support for the argument that gender on the bench matters. Consequently, some have preferred arguments for parity based on legitimacy. Grossman, for instance, suggests that sex unrepresentativeness threatens the normative legitimacy of international courts because these institutions wield public authority, yet they fail to reflect fairly those affected by their decisions. Legitimacy-based approaches have the advantage of removing the need for empirical demonstration of gender differences. They also swerve the essentialist thinking that underpins such investigations. However, in my view, they have little resonance for international institutions, which make very limited claim when compared with their national counterparts to democratic or sociological legitimacy. International institutions, including courts and tribunals, are born of the state-centric, highly political, largely unaccountable in any democratic sense structures of international law. The appointment of international judges is far from being free from the politicking and the furthering national interest, not to mention the patriarchal norms and practices that underpin the work of international institutions. So legitimacy arguments, which are compelling because they rest on the straightforward and unarguable assertion that there should be more women judges, steer us away from asking why that seemingly unproblematic imperative proves to be so elusive. They failed to place under scrutiny the structures of discrimination that undergird international institutions and that can help to explain why there are significantly fewer women, to use one identity category, in international judicial positions. Legitimacy-based arguments take international law's commitment to equality at face value and do not point to the urgent need for institutional transformation. The work that gender does within institutions and the need to address institutional structures of power and discrimination remains unaddressed. If our aims end with parity for the sake of legitimacy, if the woman judge is primarily there to even up numbers, there is a figurehead who, in her representational positioning, shores up the institution and provides it with a veneer of respectability, then the institutional resistance to addressing questions of gender remains untouched. Nonetheless, point three, gender matters. I argue from a position that understands international judges to be actors operating within highly gendered contexts in which structural exclusions, discrimination, and oppression are rendered invisible. Gender is everywhere, yet it is apparent almost nowhere. It's useful to use metaphor, I think, to illustrate this point. The totemic international judge is male, yet his apparent genderlessness mirrors the apparent genderlessness of international law. He operates within international law's constraints and serves to normalize rather than to challenge them. The female judge, in metaphorical terms, is taboo because her gender, by virtue of its counter-normative visibility, threatens to destabilize. Ultimately, in adopting an approach informed by transformative equality, when considering the role and function of international judges, gender matters because gender derives from social and legal systems that are steeped in injustice. Attention must turn to the highly gendered, racialized, heteronormative, ableist, exclusionary framework within which the judge operates. Inquiring into the ways in which gender operates in practice in international courts and tribunals, including how it is embodied, experienced, understood, and replicated by judges, can point us to the structural injustices that undergird the statistical inequalities on international benches. Paying attention to the gender of the judge can open the door to probing the wider role that gender plays within the institutions and structures of international law. In figurative terms, the judge can be understood as a male figurehead. He is a totem who operates from within, reflecting yet at the same time concealing international law's highly gendered structures. Viewed in this light, the woman judge is a conundrum, a taboo. I'm drawing here on Erica Rackley's early work, which laid the path for thinking about the woman judge in such figurative terms. She describes the woman judge in this way. Her physical appearance threatens to upset aesthetic norms. Her presence is an inescapable irritant, simultaneously confirming and disrupting the established masculinity of the bench. As such, the woman judge is almost a contradiction in terms. In the hands of the totemic male judge, the authority of international law and its institutions is upheld. And the work, read discrimination and exclusions, that gender does is rendered invisible. The female judge, on the other hand, is taboo. She is the impossible judge because she can never be genderless. The female judge is a troubling and disruptive force whose very presence places gender in the frame. By her very existence, she threatens to chaotically reveal the contingency and the discriminatory practices and values of international law. She is thus a bad fit, who is generally to be resisted, and who may be tolerated only insofar as her gender is either cloaked or alternatively inflated and emphasized to the point that the judge herself becomes a stand-in representative every woman. Recognizing this presents an opportunity to turn our gaze to the structures that make the female judge taboo. The dearth of women judges is not then just undemocratic. It does more than render the judgments of such institutions illegitimate. It is both the product of and an illustration of sustained and systemic injustice and discrimination. To recognize that judges are situated, to accept the relevance of identities, including gender and sex, opens the door to acknowledging the power structures that exclude and shape the experiences of discrimination. In the words of Sandra Burns and Paula Baron, for a judge to simultaneously speak as a woman is to speak without authority, to speak in defiance of law. Feminists in international law have drawn attention to the powerful political and legal structures that entwine to sustain power and to marginalize. The totemic judge does not make waves, but rather reflects and sustains structures of power and discrimination, and is thereby an institutional conformist. This idea has real-world implications on the practice of judging. Daniel Terrace and colleagues identifies three reasons why, internationally, judicial transformation is slow. Firstly, international judges operate more collectively, creating a community of knowledge-based experts. Secondly, international judges are reluctant radicals. Thirdly, international judges operate in fragile institutions subject to the consent of states for their survival. This all makes intuitive sense and reflects the considerable institutional constraints under which judges operate. But what of those judges who self-consciously embody taboo and conflict? I suppose I'm asking here, is the question underlying that, is Hilary Charlesworth on the ICJ going to make a difference? The picture is a complex one that reveals the to-ing and fro-ing between resistance and compliance with the normative and institutional structures of international law. Of course, it's probably uncontroversial to suggest that a female is more likely to become aware of her gender by virtue of its poor fit with institutional norms and frameworks. although women do not inhabit a universalizable category from which she can be demonstrated to judge in a particular way or have particular knowledge or experiences, judges who embody the judicial conundrum, that is, those whose identities are at odds with the patriarchal norms and structures of international law, may more readily recognize and call out its exclusions and blind spots. Such calling out is not a given. It's a brave and exhausting choice to recognize and call out structural discrimination. And it's not exclusive to women. And the judge may find herself vacillating between resistance and compliance, between totem and taboo, even in the context of a single judgment. The question then of gender is an institutional and structural one from which the individual judge cannot be isolated or indeed insulated. The architecture of international criminal law institutions, for instance, insofar as they make direct reference to gender, is illustrative here. The ICC's architecture goes beyond recognizing binary sex-based differences and calls for sensitivity to gender in all its dimensions, including, but not restricted to, gender-based violence. In the context of sexual crimes, however, the gender of the crime and of the judge become overt, and it is the female judge who is allowed a space at the table. Her gender is allowed to be on display, even to the point that we insist here in this context on the central importance of gender. One might then ask why the gender dimensions of these crimes operate in such a way that the woman judge in all her gendered glory is finally here permitted to come to the fore. Why here? The work of Karen Engel and Hilary Charlesworth has provided us with good reason to exercise caution where the female judge is over-gendered and when the same tropes and examples come to be intrinsically associated with women judges. Questions of sexual violence to the exclusion of other forms of gendered, racialized, and economic discrimination and injustice become her domain and her plight. The female judge's function is to reveal the feminized, disempowered, and shamed victim of sexual violence. One question this provokes is whether international criminal law can envisage and indeed adequately respond to sexual and gender-based violence that is perpetrated on male and masculine bodies. Transformation, that is, transformation beyond particular permissible ghettos of international law, requires us to recognize that gender is not exclusively a woman's realm. Rosemary Hunter has argued that raising the question of gender parity falls short of asking the critical question, what should women judges do once appointed? And equally, or perhaps even more pertinent question I have suggested today might be, what may women judges do once appointed? The institutional and normative constraints are considerable. The gender dimension of much of international law may be deeply entrenched and so normalized as to not be readily apparent, and the constrictions such that genuinely transformative judging appears to be all too frequently out of reach. Entering the realm of the imaginary, that is, meeting the metaphorical totemic judge on his terms, reveals the seemingly superhuman task of using judgment to reveal the entrenched structural, patriarchal, heteronormative, racialized, ableist foundations of international law. As was very kindly mentioned in the introduction, a recent collection that I edited with my wonderful colleague Troy Labors of International Judgments reimagined and rewrote from a feminist perspective a number of key international judgments and was published as Feminist Judgments in International Law. I think this collection identifies the structural aspects of mainstream international law and reveals the way in which apparently neutral rules operate in gendered and other ways to marginalize and exclude. It also demonstrates in concrete ways the transformative possibilities that feminist approaches to judging might offer if institutional constraints permit. However, and I do want to emphasize this, navigating these constraints is an ever-present challenge that was evident throughout the project and is evident in the published collection. A number of our participants reflected upon the balancing act they were performing in their judgment between utopian thinking and credibility. The results were, in the view of some participants, surprisingly restrained. The outcome of their rewriting project was surprisingly restrained in terms of the normative leaps they perform and in how far they depart from the interpretive conventions of tribunals. One group described the process as a hugely enjoyable process that enabled detailed discussion and criticisms of the law, not through a judicial prism, but a prison perhaps, as it was ultimately more of a constrictive process than we had anticipated. For our participants, the heavy weight of international law's patriarchal norms at times felt almost insurmountable. Certainly, rewriting these judgments was a considerable intellectual struggle against a disciplined grain. One group commented, "We realized how much we internalized traditional methodologies, structures, and norms of international law that we, as specialists in various areas of international law, also contribute, albeit unwittingly, to the perpetration of norms and structures of the very international law we attempt to transcend." So even in the realm of fiction, conceiving oneself as a judge free to identify and reveal the gendered foundations of international law and to challenge structural discrimination takes not a small leap of imagination. It is possible to imagine a transformative equality approach to judging that adopts a particular and deliberate positioning, attentive to the operation of power structures and their relationship to gender and other axes of discrimination. Sally Kenny's review of the literature refers to work showing that feminist ideology may well be more important than gender in predicting different votes in hypothetical cases. Rosemary Hunter has created a wish list of expectations that she might have for a feminist judge. She will identify the relevance of gender. She will judge inclusively. She will recognize the partiality of narratives laid before the court and identify with the interests of women. She will challenge bias. She will adopt feminist practical reasoning drawn from the women's lived experiences. She will promote a substantive view of equality that foregrounds systemic disadvantage and injustice. And faced with the uncertainty of making choices, she will make feminist choices. She will commit herself to full-time feminism and she will support other women. Rosemary Hunter also argues that feminist judges have a responsibility to maintain familiarity with feminist legal literature and to make use of it to consider whether and if so, how a feminist analysis may be undertaken in every case coming before them. Now, clearly, this is quite an ask. The experience of those involved in the feminist judgments in international law collection shows us that even for those setting out with clear-eyed feminist purpose, the institutional and normative barriers to judging in such a way are considerable. Questions about difference in judging prompt us to think beyond sex and gender as a category towards an understanding of how awareness of gender and other power dynamics can, does, should, and crucially is allowed to inform and shape judicial approaches. Judicial replication of international law's masculine traditional values will not engender change or end discrimination, regardless of the sex of the judge. Yet for a judge to operate at once from within international law and in a self-consciously gendered way that challenges its patriarchal structures requires her to adopt and articulate a positioning that is bordering on the superhuman. Patricia Ward speaks of being criticised for intervening too often or pushing my point too hard. Judging in a way that is committed to gender justice, in a way that works to reveal structures of injustice from within structures that are themselves steeped in patriarchy, is exhausting work. The feminist judge, the transformative judge, the superwoman judge, the gendered judge, is by definition swimming against both the jurisprudential and institutional tide. So I think the reflecting a bit more on this and drawing, that's where my thoughts formally end. And now I want to think forward. I think there's another paper to come, which will think about what we might do with this. What does it mean to, in practical terms, for women judges? And I think the main criticism that I would draw on when reflecting on Rosemary Hunter's really inspiring list is that it does really emphasize this superwoman quality of the individual judge. And as I say, my talk today was designed to emphasize the institutional and structural issues at play here. And I think the sending the individual judge out as superwoman is perhaps starting out with on a mission doomed to failure. And I think that thinking in terms of collectivity, working with judges of all genders as well, will achieve greater results than focusing on the characteristics of individual judges. So that's where I go next. I think if I may, I'll end my talk there and very much look forward to the questions and answers. But I really thank you very much for giving me the space today. Thank you.